Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And starting on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the first headline, Rent at Licton Buildings Taken by Wake. County officials say owner didn't abide by agreement. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. The article runs horizontally across the top of the page. And at the far right, there's a picture, a close-up picture of a man wearing a suit and tie. The caption reads, Harold Licton developed the Wade 1, Wade 2 buildings. Wake County officials have told tenants in two of Licton Corporation's office buildings in West Raleigh to send their rent checks to the county's revenue department in an action aimed at paying off a nearly $300,000 overdue property tax bill. A rent levy is usually a last-ditch effort to recoup overdue taxes, and it is more effective for commercial buildings than it is for housing, says Marcus Kinraid, Wake County's revenue director. They're not used often and are typically not very effective since many residential tenants are scared to run contrary to their landlord, he says. Since January 2011, Wake County's revenue department has ordered rent levies on 178 property owners, but none are as large as the $298,931 overdue tax bill for Licton's Wade buildings. The county sent a certified letter to each of the 17 tenants in the Wade 1 and Wade 2 office buildings off Edwards Mill Road on January 24, ordering that all future rent payments be sent to the county and not to the owner of their building until further notice. Among the tenants that received the letters were the Cranville, Sumner, and Hartzog Law Firm, real estate firm Jones Lang LaSalle, the Balfour Beatty Construction Firm, and several others, according to county officials. Kinraid says the county in December agreed to a three-month payment plan with Licton and that the first payment was almost 3 weeks late. It was granted with specific terms and the terms were not followed, he says. A limited liability company managed by Licton Corporation owns the 99,510-square-foot Wade 1 and the 97,282-square-foot Wade 2 and the adjacent parking deck. All were built in 2008. Licton Corporation operates under the leadership of veteran real estate developer Harold Licton. BB&T Bank is the lender for the property, according to Wake County records, having issued six promissory notes totaling $46.2 million to Harold Licton and to Licton Wade LLC since 2006 for construction and improvements to the Wade properties. As for comment, BB&T spokesman David R. White emailed this response. At BB&T, we always work closely with our clients to provide loans and financing that serve their needs and meet our lending standards. We are unable to comment further due to client confidentiality. Licton is coming off a recent court settlement with his New York investment partner, Madison International Realty, with whom he shared ownership of seven office buildings in Raleigh and in Charlotte. The Wade buildings were not part of the civil court action. Madison claimed that Harold Licton wrongly diverted $1.2 million from the properties they owned together for his personal use or for his other real estate ventures. Madison also claims that Licton put the buildings in jeopardy of foreclosure by failing to stay current on debt payments. Madison and Licton amicably resolved the case in mid-December, according to a filing in the North Carolina Business Court. Terms of the settlement with Madison are being kept confidential, but a few weeks after the settlement was filed, three limited liability companies affiliated with Licton Corporation transferred their holdings at the Torrington Office Park in Charlotte to affiliates of Madison. It's unclear whether Licton still has an ownership interest in those properties. As of February 1, no ownership change had been recorded for the two Palisades office buildings in West Raleigh, co-owned by Licton and Madison. Charlotte Business Journal staff writer Will Boy contributed to this report. And now we move down the page, still on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. And this next article takes up most of the front page. It has a black border around it. Inside that border, the top part is a picture of three men standing in a restaurant holding up boxes of pizza. And the caption reads, Bella Monica execs, CEO Jim Meese, Vice President Trevor Chambers, and President Corbett Monica, and their pizzas. And then under that in bold black letters is the headline, Hold the Gluten, Raleigh Restaurant's Pizzas Rolling into Grocery Store Freezers. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Raleigh. From the kitchen of the intimate Bella Monica restaurant in West Raleigh has come a line of gluten-free pizzas that are being stocked in the freezers at Harris Teeter, Kroger, Food Lion, and other grocers. Bella Monica founders Corbett Monica and Trevor Chambers say their subsidiary company, Bella Monica Flatbread Company, has not yet reached the $1 million level in revenue, but they are projecting sales of $1.5 million this year. The brass ring is their goal of rolling out the brand nationally and achieving a five-year projection of $13 million in revenue. By 2015, they want their products to be in 10,000 grocery stores across the country and sell the company to a larger corporation. Lofty goals, but it has been done before in the industry. One of Bella Monica's biggest competitors in the pizza category, Glutino, for example, was sold to Smart Balance for $66.3 million in August. According to analysts, Glutino was sold at 1.23 times its previous year's sales of $53.9 million. Harris Teeter has already replaced Glutino brand pizzas it used to carry at its more than 200 stores with Bella Monica's 6.5-inch pizza. Kroger started shipping Bella Monica pizzas to 609 stores in the Midwest and Western U.S. in the third quarter of 2011. Food Lion has agreed to place Bella Monica pizzas in 100 of its top grossing stores. Rapid growth is a must for us, says Jim Meese, a Raleigh business strategist serving as chairman and CEO of Flatbread. The goal, Meese says, is to attract the attention of a potential buyer such as food giants Kraft, General Mills, or Hain's Celestial Group, and sell the company within 5 years. Bella Monica Flatbread has to date received almost $451,000 in investments through friends, family, and loans, Meese says. The company is seeking $500,000 more in equity capital in 2012, he says, to ramp up sales and marketing. Looking at the growth of the gluten-free food market in recent years, their projected revenue goals may not be that far-fetched. In addition to pizza, Glutino offers bagels, pretzels, breakfast bars, cookies, and other frozen foods. The U.S. market for gluten-free foods was expected to reach $1.31 billion in the United States in 2011, more than doubling since 2005, according to research firm Euromonitor International. By 2015, gluten-free product sales are expected to garner $1.68 billion in the U.S. Ewa Hudson, head of health and wellness research for Euromonitor, noted in a September report that even consumers who aren't restricted by complications of celiac disease feel rewarded when they eat gluten-free products. They don't feel bloated. They don't have belly aches. This usually encourages them to repeat the purchase, Hudson says. The advantage that Bella Monica Flatbread Company has over many of its competitors, Chamber says, is that it is the only gluten-free pizza company in the country that also has its own restaurant. The restaurant is our focus group, he says. It gives us the ability to get a nice read on the customer base and have dialogue with them. There are some nights we run out of our gluten-free menus. The 6.5-inch pizzas retail for $6.99, while a 10-inch pie is $9.99. Flatbread outsources the production of its pizzas to a specialty food manufacturer in Vineland, New Jersey. And then within this article, there's actually a separate, smaller article with a gray background that has the headline, Here's Who Benefits from Food Without Gluten, also written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. Once confined to specialty health stores, the gluten-free food category is fast becoming mainstream due to the product's health benefits for certain people. It is estimated that nearly 100 million Americans suffer from celiac disease or are in other ways adversely affected by gluten, a key protein in wheat, barley, rye, and malt. Celiac disease is a genetic autoimmune disease that reacts adversely to gluten and interferes with the absorption of nutrients from food. It can cause gastrointestinal and neurological issues, infertility, skin rashes, and cancer. The only remedy is strict adherence to a gluten-free diet. Zach Becker of Raleigh was diagnosed with celiac disease in 2008 and has since made it a mission to educate others about the seriousness of the disease and to help other gluten-free followers find appropriate foods in the triangle. He started a blog called Gluten Free Raleigh in 2009 and has become a regular customer of Bella Monica's and other local restaurants with gluten-free menus. I've known Bella Monica co-owner Trevor Chambers since 2008 and have been watching the gluten-free pizza company grow, Becker says. I love their products and have tried just about everything out there at least once. Their stuff is awesome and is a regular purchase for me. Whole Foods Market in 2004 opened its gluten-free bakehouse in Morrisville, where it makes gluten-free baked goods sold through its stores across the country. Other restaurants and grocery chains in the Triangle that offer gluten-free foods include Z Pizza, Mellow Mushroom, Earth Fare, and Harmony Farms. And there's one last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This one runs vertically along the right side of the page. The headline, Union Workers Out at RDU as American Cuts. This article is written by Chris Basden and Chris Bagley with the dateline of Morrisville. And underneath the article, there's a picture of the outside of RDU Airport of an American Airlines plane. The caption reads, American Airlines will outsource some ground services. American Airlines plans to replace 95 unionized employees at Raleigh-Durham International Airport with contracted baggage handlers, mechanics, and other service workers as it restructures in bankruptcy, union representatives have been told. The change is not likely to be good news for passengers in an industry that already has plenty of quality and service problems, says airline consultant Bob Mann. That's because third-party contractors tend to have less pride in their brands than direct employees, partly due to the fact that they're generally less well compensated than airlines union employees. Ground support contractors must only pay local market wages, Mann says. That's the same hiring that a fast food place does, says Mann. The news also is bad for American's employees at RDU, says Glenn Jeans, who is the Transport Workers Union representative for American's RDU baggage handlers and other ground crew, noting that unions made about $1.8 billion in concessions to the carrier amid an earlier round of cost-cutting in 2003, he says. It's terrible. It's a shame. All these sacrifices that we made, now we'll be making more. Gene says he expects some of the 95 at RDU to be offered positions at larger airports over the course of 6 to 8 months, depending on how quickly it, sister American Eagle and parent company AMR Corporation, exit bankruptcy. AMR filed for Chapter 11 reorganization in November. Jeans learned of management's decision along with other union representatives on February 1 during meetings at American's Fort Worth, Texas headquarters. He says the airline is making a similar move at other airports where unions have a significant presence and where it operates fewer than 20 flights a day. American and American Eagle employ a total of 290 people at RDU, 167 with the mainline carrier, and 123 with American Eagle, including ground workers, maintenance workers, freight workers, and mechanics. Of the mainline employees, 95 belong to the Transport Workers Union. Those union employees mainly support American's mainline operations at RDU rather than Eagle's operations. Under management's plan, only 10 airports will keep large ground crews that are unionized and work directly for American. Jean says AMR has roughly 80,000 workers worldwide. During the February 1 talks with union representatives, managers said the company would lay off between 13,000 and 15,000 employees as part of its plan to bring the bankrupt company back to profitability. AMR is the only major U.S. airline company not to have gone through bankruptcy in recent years. American has the highest rate of unionization and performs a larger share of maintenance and other work in-house than other U.S. airlines. AMR carriers operate a total of 35 daily departures at RDU, according to RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin. That figure includes a dozen flights by American and 23 by American Eagle. The two carriers occupy 8 of the 36 gates at RDU's Terminal 2. American was once the dominant carrier at RDU, having opened the old Terminal C at its southeastern regional hub in June 1987. AA closed the hub in 1995, and RDU later bought out the carrier's lease on the facility so it could redevelop the building into what is now Terminal 2. More than 532,000 passengers boarded American's mainline flights at RDU last year, the third most of any major carrier. The airline's traffic fell by about 1% from 2010, a slightly smaller drop than most other major carriers suffered. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, in tough market, modernist home goes for $1.3 million. And right under that, there's a picture of the modernist home. It's very rectangular in shape with a lot of windows on the front and a pond in front of it. And the caption reads, home sits on 25 acres. Who says houses aren't selling? At least one has, and it's a beaut. Clark Griswold, a modernist-style home in South Raleigh that's been featured in regional magazines and was chosen as the House of the Day in an October 2010 issue of the Wall Street Journal, has sold for $1.3 million. The buyers are Michael T. Cannon and Constance G. Cannon, according to county records. Bobby Thompson and Diane Thompson, owners of a local land grading company, built the 6,300-square-foot home on Dirt Peeler Road near Garner in 2001, and put the property up for sale in 2010 for close to $2 million, later deciding to drop the asking price to $1.4 million. The two-story home was designed by architect David Davenport and is engineered of heavy steel and wood construction covered in real stucco. The 25-acre property also has a go-kart track, a pond, and a detached 3,400-square-foot building with a three-car garage. Biz hopes to get some tax help from one of these Wolfpack students. A team from the North Carolina State University Poole College of Management took home first place in an accounting competition held by the American Institute of Certified Public Accounting, or AICPA, which bases its operations center in Durham. The first round began August 29, when more than 200 teams began working on solutions to a 2011 case dealing with accounting fraud and forensics. In the final round in December, each team gave a 10-minute presentation, followed by 5 to 7 minutes of questions and answers with the judges. The winning team, which calls itself Wolfpack in the Black, members are Alan Perry, the captain, Sienna Roby, Brian Jones, and Amanda Dew. Professor Eileen Taylor served as faculty advisor. What could be more American than baseballed? Yep, you read it right. Baseballed. Here's the gig. The St. Baldrick's Foundation, which raises money for cancer research, has a new initiative called Baseballed. Through it, baseball programs ranging from college teams to entire amateur leagues agree to hold fundraising events at which heads are shaved, thus baseballed. Among those championing the program is Chase Jones, who was diagnosed with cancer in 2006 while a student at UNC Chapel Hill, where he was a manager and bullpen catcher for the baseball team. Upcoming head shaving events will be at NC State's Doak Field on March 17 and at UNC's Beauchamp Stadium in April. High schools signed on include Cary High School and Chapel Hill High School, and one of the region's premier youth leagues, North Wake Baseball, will go bald on March 24. Are you ready for some volleyball? That's coming up at the Raleigh Convention Center on March 10 through 11, when, for the fourth consecutive year, the city will host a stop of the Mid-Atlantic Power League that's made up of elite teams along the East Coast. Coming to town will be 124 teams from New York to Georgia to undertake tournament play on 23 courts at the RCC. Serve. Mention shrimp and grits to the non-initiated and you'll get a puzzled look. Order shrimp and grits in two separate restaurants and you'll likely to get two different concoctions. While the dish has become somewhat commonplace hereabouts, recipes can vary widely. On February 25 at the Carolina Inn in Chapel Hill, seven local chefs will go head-to-head in whipping up their own versions of shrimp and grits. Called the Chapel Hill Carborough Chef's Throwdown, Folks can watch the cooking for $15, a portion of which will go to TABLE, an Orange County nonprofit helping children at risk of hunger. The event is scheduled from 1 to 4 p.m., and patrons will be able to taste the results and vote for their favorite version. Among chefs scheduled to cook are Jeremy Blankenship, chef at Tyler's Tap Room; Trey Cleveland, executive chef at Top of the Hill; Adam Cobb, executive chef at Glass Half Full; Brett Jennings, executive chef and owner of Elaine's on Franklin; Vimalia Rajendran, executive chef and owner of Vimala's Curry Blossom Cafe; Jimmy Reel, executive chef at Carolina Crossroads Restaurant and Bar; and Adam Rose, executive chef at Il Palio. If all else fails, Governor Beverly Perdue can go into boat sales after she finishes her term. The governor last fall visited China and apparently convinced a group of business executives that some mighty fine boats are made in North Carolina. So now comes word that a 60-foot yacht built by Hatteras Yachts in New Bern has been sold to a group that runs the Hanan Cruise and Yacht Association in Hanan Province. It's the first Hatteras-built yacht sold in China, and along with the purchase comes an agreement by the Chinese Association to operate a dealership for Hatteras yachts in southern China. Last year, we announced our intentions to enter China, including the opening of a sales office in Shenzhen, says James R. Meyer, Hatteras president and CEO. We are now shipping our first sold product. Hatteras Yachts has added 450 jobs in New Bern over the past 2 years. A recent article in the Daily Tar Heel, UNC Chapel Hill's student newspaper, featured some past student body presidents in a sort of "Where Are They Now?" piece. Among them was Raleigh lawyer Bob Spearman, who was UNC's student body chief in 1964 to 65. Asked whether the experience helped him later in life, Spearman responded, "Work as student body president was helpful for getting me into more political matters than I would have otherwise done." Indeed, Spearman built a stellar practice as one of North Carolina's smartest litigators during his long tenure with Parker, Poe, and Raleigh, where he now serves as counsel. Alas, the DTH reported that Spearman is retired and worked in Parker, Poe's Charlotte office. A 2008 graduate of UNC Chapel Hill, who attended the North Carolina Governor's School in 2003, has decided to give back to the school through his art. Robert Wells has published a book of poetry called War on Xmas that's available as an ebook on Amazon for $3.50. He'll donate his 70% of sales to help support the North Carolina Governor's School. Alums and other supporters have raised money to keep the school going and hope to find a permanent underwriting method. Wells told the Daily Tar Heel that his days at the Governor's School were vital to development of his artistic talents. "It really helped me open up and figure out who I am and what I want to be doing," he said. "The people there actually want to learn." There's now an app for Duke University students and staff who get confused about which bus to take to get around the university's two campuses. The university's buses have been outfitted with GPS tracking systems that allow students to find out where a bus is in real time through a website or a mobile app. Called Translock, the system goes live at the end of this month. Wonder if it'll pick up where Coach K is at the moment. The five guest chefs at the Interfaith Food Shuttle's annual Taste of Hope Gala dinner, held recently at the Umstead Hotel in Cary, took it easy on MC Greg Fischel, who each year manages to butcher the names of many dishes being served. The white bean soup, seared and diver scallops, duck confit, Fischel proudly exclaimed. Sorbet, smoked beef tenderloin, and some other dishes seemed simple enough, but Fischel, chief meteorologist for WRAL-TV in Raleigh, poked a little fun at the dish descriptions conjured up by the chefs. Guest chefs included 18 Seaboard's Jason Smith, Midtown Grill's Scott James, Coquette Brazier's Beth Littlejohn, and the Umstead's Scott Crawford. Contributing to Biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle and Jason DeBrun. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to has the headline, "How One Company Saved an Entire Crop." And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Morrisville. And the article runs horizontally across the top of the page. At the far right, there's a picture of some fields of tobacco with two barn buildings in the back. The caption reads, Alliance One deals globally in the tobacco business. For a company that doesn't seek publicity, global cigarette tobacco processor Alliance One International makes plenty of business deals and headlines. Some are international, while others are closer to home, including the firm's recent role in salvaging the 2011 growing season for scores of North Carolina tobacco farmers. Alliance One seldom comments on either. They just seem to be focused on running their business, says Davenport analyst Ann Gerken. The firm's role in North Carolina's 2011 growing season isn't generally known outside of agriculture circles. Already toting up their losses from flooding caused by Hurricane Irene, many eastern North Carolina farmers suddenly found themselves facing an even more vexing problem. The distribution company that had agreed to buy their crops pulled back on the agreements, citing financial difficulties. That left the growers with no ready market, says North Carolina journalist Chris Bickers, who produces the online Tobacco Farmer newsletter. Enter Alliance One. Already a buyer of North Carolina Leaf, the company announced it would accept delivery on all the tobacco originally put under contract by the reneging distributor. What they did was highly praised, says Bickers, who adds, however, that he's had a difficult time determining just how many extra tons Alliance One ended up buying. Getting information out of them is not easy, he says. Estimates range all the way from 25 million pounds to 100 million pounds. To put those quantities into context, North Carolina growers produced roughly 350 million pounds of flue-cured tobacco in 2010, according to North Carolina State University expert Blake Brown. With 3,300 global employees and annual revenue in the $2 billion range, Alliance One buys tobacco from farmers in 45 countries, processes the leaf, and sells it to cigarette makers. In its latest international deal, a joint venture with China Tobacco, Alliance One signed contracts with 6,000 Brazilian growers. Once processed, the leaf goes into cigarettes sold in China, one of the fastest-growing consumer markets in the world. They have wanted to increase their presence in Asia, says Gerken. This will play a part. Since late 2010, Alliance's direction has been charted by Raleigh-based private equity investor Mark Kihea, a longtime Alliance One board member who took over as CEO with the mission of cutting costs in the face of declining orders. For the 6 months ending September 30, the company posted losses of $2.4 million on sales of $876 million, according to federal securities documents. The firm's shares trade on the New York Stock Exchange currently in the $3.10 range. The company's 52-week high was $4.24. An attempt to reach Kihaya for comment was not successful. And now our next article. It's in the center of the page and goes all the way down to the bottom of the page. Has a black border around it. Inside that black border, the top third has a picture of a man sitting in a chair, casually dressed. And next to him is, in bold white letters, is the headline of the article, The Cost of Special Medicine. And then under that, there is a caption for the picture. It says, Cameron Cox helps doctors manage their businesses. And then under that starts the first article written by Jason DeBrun with a dateline of Chapel Hill. We'll read this one first, and then we'll get to a second article that's also in this small section. The likelihood that a primary care doctor will refer a patient to a specialist nearly doubled over the past decade, contributing to higher costs for patients and insurers. Patients who are referred to specialists tend to incur greater health care spending compared with those who remain within primary care, concludes a group of Harvard Medical School doctors who analyzed referral patterns since 1999. Between 1999 and 2009, the probability that a physician visit would result in a referral to a specialist increased by 94%, total visits resulting in a referral increase by 159% to 105 million. The researchers, Dr. Michael Barnett, Zuri Song, and Dr. Bruce Landon found, Gregory Griggs, Executive Vice President of the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians, says primary care doctors, a group his organization represents, should not be blamed for rising health care costs. Instead, he sees a broader problem in a health care system that defaults to more tests instead of trying to promote health. Our system has valued doing things to people as opposed to managing patients and using the cognitive skills of the doctor, he says. Also, he points to patient demands. Consumers today want the latest, greatest test and the latest, greatest technology, which they are more likely to find with a specialist, he says. A decrease in reimbursements, both from private insurers and government programs such as Medicare, make it more difficult for primary care doctors to spend large amounts of time with each patient, says Cameron Cox, founder of management services OnCall, a Chapel Hill company that offers business advice and services to private practice donors. This effect on primary care would be to see the patient quickly, assess the issue, and turf them to a specialist for treatment of a preliminary diagnosis, he says. More education about health care plays a role as well, says Dr. David Tsai with Rex Primary Care of Holly Springs. He has patients who will simply go to a specialist before seeing him, he says. Sometimes that even results in the specialist recommending the patient go back to the primary care doctor first, almost like a reverse referral. Specialists will likely know more about the area of expertise than a primary care doctor, so referring to a specialist, while more costly, should theoretically result in better care. The Harvard researchers acknowledge this point, but note that overuse of referrals could increase use of healthcare services without benefit. Instead, a coordinated care effort is required to best keep a patient healthy instead of just treating various symptoms. And then below that article, there's another article in the same section that's cordoned off by the black outline. And the headline on this article is Coordination, a Key to Helping Cut Costs. And this also has a dateline of Raleigh, written by Jason DeBrun. Terms such as medical home or accountable care organizations have moved into the hot button column, particularly in Washington, D.C., where leaders say they are looking for ways to lower health care spending. The upshot of such efforts is to better coordinate care as a way to shave health care spending. That's good in theory, but achieving such coordination is easier said than done, and it requires more time from primary care physicians who are often overworked as it is. Locally, Community Care of North Carolina works to reduce costs by establishing regional networks of healthcare providers, ranging from doctors to hospitals, social service agencies, and even pharmacists. An example of the medical home model, members of the network work together to manage the care of patients. Raleigh-based CCNC says an analytics firm, Treo Solutions, concluded after a study that CCNC saved nearly $1.5 billion in the 3 years from 2007 through 2009. The group doesn't necessarily discourage referrals, but it does work to reduce inappropriate referrals or emergency use, which can drastically increase costs. In many cases, that means empowering the primary care physician to better manage a patient's health. CCNC is less about reducing specialist utilization than about improving access to the most appropriate care, says Paul J. Mahoney, CCNC Director of Communications. A large segment of CCNC's members are covered by Medicaid, but they look to form partnerships in the private markets as well in an effort to reduce costs throughout the system. And now we'll move just to the right of that article. The next article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the dateline of Durham. The headline, Japanese metal firm sniffs area to open in U.S. And underneath the article, there's a picture of a man standing outside wearing a suit and tie. The caption reads, Broker Brett Mueller not sure where project stands. A Japanese metal pipe producer is looking into opening a production line in the U.S. that could employ as many as 50 people, and much of its focus has been on properties in the Triangle. Kaya Industrial Company makes stainless steel pipes and metal products used for automotive antennas, broadcast equipment, and other products. Kaya hasn't had an active production plant in the U.S. in more than 20 years. Kaya's president, Yuzo Kaya, made at least two visits in September and in December, touring warehouse properties in Durham and Alamance counties with a 50,000 square foot requirement, according to several sources close to the deal. Yuzo Kaya in October filed incorporation papers in North Carolina for an entity called Kaya Products LLC. However, no one on this side of the Pacific is for sure when or if Kaya will make a decision about a U.S. production plant. We're not sure where it stands, says Brett Muller, a broker with Capital Associates in Cary, who assisted Kaya's executives and their interpreter in a December tour of one building in Durham and two buildings in Mebane. Vernon Averett, a broker with Pickett Sprouse Real Estate in Durham, says he showed the Kaya executives a 50,000-square-foot building on Hillsborough Road in Durham. But when they learned that another prospect was interested in leasing the building, their frustration was evident. He couldn't believe I was showing it to someone else. It made no sense at all to him, Averett says. Executives of Kaya, which is based in the landlocked Gunma Prefecture of Japan, did not respond to an email request for comment or for details about its U.S. plans. Sources say that leaders from the North Carolina Department of Commerce did meet with the company's president during Governor Beverly Perdue's trip to Asia in October, but they say Kaya has been conducting its own search in the Triangle without assistance from Commerce's business recruiters. According to the Commerce Department, about 160 Japanese companies now have offices or production plants in the state. AW North Carolina, for example, completed a $100 million expansion of its automotive transmission production line in North Durham in October and employs about 1,400 people. AW North Carolina is a subsidiary of Japan-based Aisin AW Company. Japan is North Carolina's fourth largest trading partner, with exports of products and services worth more than $1.7 billion. Commerce estimates that international investment and job creation has accounted for about 15% of all investment and jobs in North Carolina over the past 10 years, amounting to more than $9 billion in investments and 40,000 jobs. Where PNC places regional exec being closely watched, betting is Atlanta will win out over Raleigh, Florida. That's the headline on the next article, written by Lee Weisbecker with a dateline of Raleigh. As yet unannounced in its takeover of Raleigh-based RBC Bank is where PNC Financial plans to install the top executive of its new six-state southern footprint. Bank spokesman Fred Solomon says both the title and home base of the southern head will be announced at a later date. Not sure at this point, says Solomon. The choice, when made, will reveal what the Pittsburgh financial services giant considers to be the prime location in a southern penetration that has brought it 426 branch offices scattered from Virginia to South Florida. Some 44% of those branches, 189, are in the Carolinas, while 52%, 223, are in Georgia, Florida, and Alabama. With the $3.45 billion acquisition just weeks from completion, PNC is filling out other parts of the new management structure. Paula Freiland, a 21-year PNC vet, tapped to be Eastern North Carolina Regional President, will oversee corporate and commercial banking, wealth management, and PNC's institutional investment business. Longtime RBC Bank executive Bill Bunn, also to be based in Raleigh, will oversee PNC's 189 Carolinas branches as retail market manager in both states. Freiland and the other regional presidents are the face of PNC in their locations, even though they do not oversee all the operations in an area, Solomon says. Freiland, along with the regional presidents appointed in Western North Carolina, Georgia, and Florida, will report to the bank's still unnamed top southern executive. Bunn will report in a separate chain of command to PNC retail operations executives. In the bank's new southern footprint, South Florida and Atlanta will compete with the Triangle for attention. PNC had already acquired 133 Florida branches before the RBC deal brought it 89 more. Last summer, it purchased 27 additional Atlanta branch offices to go along with the 49 it is acquiring from RBC. Analysts who follow Southern banking in general and PNC in particular say that Atlanta makes an attractive Southern hub from a geography standpoint. It does if you're trying to build an operation that goes from North Carolina to South Florida, says Rockdale Securities analyst Richard Bove. Atlanta would be at the center and would make more sense than Orlando or anywhere else in Florida. Banking analyst Don Coker, who works out of Atlanta, agrees. Atlanta would be my bet also, he says. Plus, there is lots of available office space here as well. Feds put bank on notice to pay off TARP. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. North Carolina's remaining TARP banks, including four with Triangle connections, are being reminded that they need a plan to exit the federal program. The U.S. Treasury, intent on winding down the Troubled Asset Relief Program, recently made the point in letters to the banks and then hired an investment banking firm to contact the lenders to reinforce the message. About 20 North Carolina banks still hold $345 million under the program, which was put in place in response to the financial crisis of 2008. Nationally, around 350 community banks still hold $17 billion in TARP, and on January 31, the Congressional Budget Office estimated the TARP likely will have a $23 billion loss in 2012, primarily because of the lackluster performance of two companies that received big bailouts, American International Group and General Motors. However, the Treasury has recouped most of the bailout money, about $315 billion of the $411 billion, according to the CBO. In the Triangle, Crescent State Bank has yet to repay $25 million, Yadkin Valley Cardinal in Durham, $49 million, Bank of North Carolina, which recently purchased Durham's Keysource Commercial Bank, $31 million, and ECB Bancorp, now with five Triangle branches, $18 million. To cash out, the banks would have to repurchase the preferred shares of stock they originally sold to the Treasury in exchange for receiving the federal infusions. The challenge they face in doing so, says analyst Grady Bailey of KBW, will be to pull off the transactions without draining reserves or impacting profitability. And it doesn't look like the government will be agreeing to any discounts, Bailey says. So far, Treasury officials haven't imposed deadlines for the bank exits, but banks without any sort of exit plan are being led through their options by Houlihan Lokey Capital Incorporated, the firm Treasury hired to help out in the effort. ECB CFO Tom Crowder says his conversation with Houlihan Lokey was probably one of the shortest they've had because ECB has a plan. Currently wrapping up a $75 million fundraiser, Crowder says once that is done, we will repay TARP. Scott Custer, CEO of Piedmont Community Bank Holdings, which now owns Crescent, couldn't be reached for comment. Jan Holler, CFO of Yadkin Cardinal, also was unavailable. But the bank, which lost $17 million for all of 2011, did not include TARP repayment in its list of top 2012 goals in a recent analyst conference call. Moreover, CEO Joe Towle says the bank isn't planning any immediate fundraisers. Banks, which currently pay 5% annual interest on the federal cash, will see those interest charges begin to go up in another 24 months. To date, Treasury officials have released no estimates on whether they believe the push to cash out TARP will lead to any additional curtailment of bank lending. And our next article is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Morrisville. The headline, Gentris Aims for China Market. Gentris Corporation has been quietly expanding its operations and by this summer will have doubled in size from just 2 years ago. The company provides applied clinical pharmacogenomic services, which in layman's terms means it runs tests in a lab to see how new drugs will affect people, specifically identifying the effects of a drug on a patient's genetic profile. It's a step taken before a drug goes into human trials aimed at narrowing the trial population or at providing warnings about any dangers for potential trial participants with certain genetic makeups. In the summer of 2010, Rick Williams left the Hamner Institutes for Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park to take over as chief executive of Gentris in Mooresville. Back then, Gentris employed 30 workers in 12,000 square feet. By June this year, Gentris will employ twice that many workers in 25,000 square feet, Williams says. The company does not disclose revenue and profitability numbers, but in the late 2000s, it was clocking about $3.5 million in sales. As part of its growth, Gentris will open a facility in China where it can reach a population of 1.3 billion people the company could not reach before. The data from research in China will be sent to Morrisville, and the trials will be monitored from there as well, resulting in more hires locally. That is the largest emerging market, but the patient population has not been studied in large trials, Williams says. Gentris works mostly with specialty pharma companies that focus on niche products. Scott Clark, the company's chief scientist, says Gentris works in a variety of therapeutic areas, including oncology, central nervous system disorders, and infectious disease and hepatology. In the past year, Gentris worked directly with 12 of the companies listed on the MedAd annual summary of the top 25 biopharma list. In addition, it is currently working for or creating proposals for an additional 7 companies on that list, Williams says. Gentris was initially funded by a local angel investors and Research Triangle Ventures. And accompanying this article, there's another smaller article with a dark gray background, also written by Jason DeBrun, that has the headline, Companies Find Ways to Do Business China's Way. Chinese government regulations restrict what may be exported out of the Asian nation. Not allowed are samples from patients taken inside the nation, which severely limits the scope of work for research organizations such as Gentris. A workaround is to set up a research office in China where scientists can do their patient sampling and then send the data back to researchers in the U.S. When Gentris opens its office in China, it can research how various pharmaceutical products will work in that population and be able to offer reports on the Chinese population similar to what it does for other populations around the globe. Opening a facility in China not only will help Gentris work around regulations, but it will also give the company a familiarity with that patient population it would not otherwise have, says Jeanette Song, a business professor at Duke University Fuqua School of Business with a specialty in Chinese studies. Payments in arrears to lawyers rose during hard times. That's the headline on our next article, written by Chris Bagley with a Dateline of Raleigh. And along with this article, there's a picture of a man sitting, dressed casually, sitting at a table. Looks to be in a comfortable place, maybe his office, with books and pictures behind him. The caption reads, Corporate Counsel Association's Marvin Genzer says some clients are pushing back on their bills. Companies are delaying, renegotiating, or ignoring what they owe their law firms, even as some signs point toward improving business conditions. While many attorneys say work has picked up over the past year, it's not always followed by payment. Some relatively small firms continue struggling to collect from their clients, which also tend to be relatively small businesses. At some larger firms in the Triangle, managing partners say the amounts they write off each month have plateaued or have begun to decline. Firms with 21 to 40 attorneys wrote off an average of $13,445 per attorney in 2011, according to a national survey by ALM Legal Intelligence. That figure has grown by 23% since 2006, or about 4% per year, even as most firms' revenue has only recently climbed back to previous levels. A small group of clients are not making it, and those balances don't get paid, says David Liggett, managing partner of Ragsdale Liggett, a Raleigh law firm with 24 attorneys. Corporate bankruptcy filings usually list at least one law firm as a creditor, and law firms often are among the largest. Several large bankruptcies have hit in the last month, including that of a Garner Construction Company, whose January 24 Chapter 11 petition showed $65,000 owed to Anderson Jones, a 6-attorney firm in Raleigh. Including firms of all sizes, write-offs rose 14.5% over those 5 years to $13,538 per attorney, according to ALM, a unit of American Lawyer Media. Write-offs in the southeastern region rose 24% to an average of $14,240. The growing amounts reflect clients' financial troubles and occasionally renegotiated fees, according to managing partners and in-house counsels. Companies now are pushing back on some of the bills, says Marvin Genzler, executive director of the Research Triangle chapter of the Association of Corporate Counsel. Corporate financial managers see professional services such as law and accounting firms as more lenient with bills than most other vendors, Genzler says. A lot of firms had receivables problems before the recession, and it's just grown and grown and grown, says Lee Rosen, a divorce attorney who advises other firms on practice management. They will stay with a client long after it makes economic sense. At some point, the lawyer thinks, well, if I stop now, I'll never get my money. Tom Boyle, a Raleigh accountant who does the books for small law firms, advises them to give clients as many payment options as are feasible and send invoices frequently while the work still is fresh in the client's minds. Managing partners at several large firms say they've taken steps to curb the problem, such as applying retainers to the final payment rather than the first. Better billing and collections practices have helped. Moore and Van Allen push its uncollectible amounts back down to where they were before the recession, says Arlene Hanks, managing member of the firm's Research Triangle Park office. Managing partners say delays in payments are also a growing problem, albeit one that isn't reflected in the ALM figures. Even larger firms that write off just 1% to 3% of billings say clients that once paid in 20 to 30 days have been taking 45 days or more. Most firms charge interest on late payments, often 1.5% monthly after 30 days. Still, they're quick to waive those charges and slow to move toward the last resort, a lawsuit for money owed. A lawsuit is the final hammer, says Boyle. The last thing an attorney wants to do is sue his client. Label change could propel sales of Biogen's MS medicine. Company leaders mum on whether Sabari output might be increased at Triangle Plant. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with from Research Triangle Park. And Sabari is spelled T-Y-S-A-B-R-I. Biogen IDEC is maintaining a conservative outlook for its blockbuster drug, Tysabri, even after the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved a label change that some analysts say could result in a doubling of sales. For the time being, Biogen will not hire new workers locally, though spokesman Mike McBriarty says the company might increase production in the future or hire service staff for patients treated with Tysabri. Biogen IDEC, headquartered in Weston, Massachusetts, employs 900 in its Research Triangle Park facility. Significantly for the Triangle, the entire worldwide production of Sabari, a powerful multiple sclerosis drug, happens here in RTP. Already, Tysabri is recording more than $1 billion in annual sales, and some analysts say total sales could top $3 billion in the next 5 years. Biogen shares some Tysabri revenue with Elan Corporation, based in Dublin, Ireland. Still, that does not necessarily translate to more production in Raleigh-Durham. Biogen will complete a nearly $500 million facility in Hillerød, Denmark this year that will produce various products, including Tysabri. Company officials did not give a breakdown of the percentage of future production locally or in Denmark. Biogen also uses the RTP plant for a portion of its Avonex production, another multiple sclerosis therapy with more than $2 billion in annual sales. Tysabri is frequently used when MS has advanced or is advancing quickly. Unfortunately, the drug can increase the risk of progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, or PML, a serious brain infection that can lead to death in some patients. The label change was approved after Biogen discovered a way to better identify who would likely be at risk for PML, which means those at a lower risk also could be identified. That additional information is what led some analysts to increase sales projections because doctors could more confidently prescribe the treatment. Others, however, say the method to test these patients, called an assay, has existed for nearly a year. Just because it is now on the label will not magically increase sales, they say. And we'll stop there with that article, as it the rest of it just goes with the back and forth over whether or not sales will increase or not. But for our final few minutes, we'll turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Raleigh's Tipton files for $66 million bankruptcy. Prominent local developer Mark Tipton has filed for personal bankruptcy, listing $66 million in liabilities compared to $1.9 million in assets. That total comes largely from deficiencies that remained after banks foreclosed last year on properties in Northeast Raleigh and the Wilmington area that belonged to Raleigh-based Whistler Investment Group, LLC, and other corporate entities that Tipton controlled, according to attorney David Warren of Pointer Spruill. Warren is representing one of the banks. Report: Delta may bid for U.S. Airways. Shares of U.S. Airways Group Incorporated were up by 5% in mid-morning trading on reports that Delta Airlines may bid to buy the company. Atlanta-based Delta is the world's largest airline by passenger count and Raleigh-Durham International Airport's second largest after Southwest Airlines. U.S. Airways ranks 10th worldwide and 4th at RDU. U.S. Airways is based in Tempe, Arizona, and has hubs in Phoenix, Charlotte, and Philadelphia. Triangle unemployment rate rises to 8%. Unemployment grew throughout the Triangle and through most of North Carolina in December, reflecting continuing job cuts by construction companies and government agencies and a slowdown in hiring by other companies. Unemployment rose to 8% in the Triangle in December, according to a news release issued by the North Carolina Department of Commerce on Wednesday. That was up from 7.8% in November and up from 7.6% in December 2010. Those rates are not adjusted for seasonal factors. Caterpillar to add 199 jobs in the Triangle. Caterpillar Incorporated is planning a $33 million expansion that will add 199 jobs in Johnston County over 5 years, according to Governor Beverly Perdue's office. In Clayton, Caterpillar will expand its existing operations, which are part of the Building Construction Products Division. Upon completion, the Clayton facility will be the world source for several models of small wheel loaders produced by Caterpillar. Engineering and design work for BCP products will take place at a new engineering and test facility near Caterpillar's Clayton manufacturing facility. Greenfire Development plans Durham apartment project. Greenfire Development said Wednesday that it plans to build a $10 million transit-oriented residential project just south of Durham's multimodal transit station. And we'll stop right there. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. Our phone number, 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.